It's my honor and privilege to call to order the convention of 2018 of the American Council of the Blind.
Good evening. Welcome to the August edition of Council Connection. I'm your host, Steve Dresser. This month, as promised, we'll be looking at the ACB National Conference and Convention, which took place in St. Louis from June 29th to July 6th. Of course, we can't cover everything that happened at the convention in one show. We don't have time. But we'll be looking at a few of the highlights, ranging from technology to education to video description. To begin, let's hear from our Bay State Scholarship winner, as introduced by Denise Coley, the chair of the Scholarship Committee.
This year's recipient of the Bay State Council Scholarship is Dexter Rowell. Dexter is from Hyde Park, Massachusetts, and actually is a member of the Bay State Council, so that's very cool. He is a graduate student majoring in law. He is attending Northeastern University of Law in Boston. Dexter.
Yay, Dexter.
Morning, everybody. First and foremost, I'd like to give praise and thanks to the Most High Power above us, without whom nothing is possible. I'd like to thank ACB and the Bay State Council for the Blind for their generosity. I'm honored to be here. I've had a really great time. I'd also like to thank my family because of, without their sacrifices and encouragement, I wouldn't be here at all. I'd like to close by saying that I'm honored to walk in the footsteps of Thurgood Marshall and Charles Hamilton Houston, who not only were once-in-a-generation legal minds, but showed me and inspired me how it felt to be young, gifted, and Black. Thank you.
That was Dexter Rowell, our Bay State Scholarship winner, and certainly someone who I think will do us proud. Transitioning from high school to college is tough for anybody, and when you throw blindness into the mix, it can be even more challenging. Leslie Thatcher is the director of a new program launched by the Perkins School to help students prepare for the challenges of college life. Here she is to tell us more about it.
I've spent almost 30 years working on the transition from high school to college in my career. And this is a really critical one that's challenging for all students. I think it's especially challenging now in these very complex times with technology and so many layers of things to learn. For context, I want to raise the idea of someone named Carol Dweck, who some of you may know from popular media reports and things like that. She's a professor at Stanford University who really popularized the idea of, you might have heard, grit, resilience, and the growth mindset. And that is something where students who have a growth mindset believe that that challenges and failures are opportunities to learn, and they believe that they can keep learning, versus someone with a fixed mindset who believes that a failure just demonstrates that they're not capable or that they're not smart. So we are working with a growth mindset, and it's a teachable thing, and college success is designed to empower students with a growth mindset. We know with the college-bound students that we are working with, if you're a VR counselor or a TVI, or you're a mom or a dad or an aunt or an uncle or a member of all of the affiliates out there in the country, you're working with young people. And we see that young people are not completing college at a rate of about 60%, young people with blindness and visual impairment. And we are working to try and change some of those statistics. My questions as a professional in this field for so long is, how and when do we do the work to empower these students with the skills they need for success? When do we work on non-cognitive factors such as a sense of belonging, a sense and set of goal setting in school, a feeling of self-regulation as they encounter challenges and obstacles. How do we begin to empower students to understand that they can overcome and persist in the face of these challenges? How do we squeeze that in a traditional four-year high school curriculum while also trying to teach orientation and mobility, other blindness skills, and just getting through the curriculum in high school? We know the consequences when we don't do it because our students arrive in college not ready to succeed. We know that our high school curriculum in general is designed for four-year completion, right? And we know that it's designed to be completed in 4 years by typically sighted students. And I'm starting to wonder if maybe an extra 9 months, like our program, may help some of those students who need some extra time. For our students generally, we want to work with increasing their sense of efficacy and their sense and goal setting in college. So what we are doing at Perkins is addressing some of those skill sets. So what we have done is we've developed a 9-month residential program. It's designed to, based on research that Perkins did, interviewing college students who had persisted in college, college students who had stopped attending college, college professors, Office of Disability Services, and we definitely identified some themes. This is not going to come as a surprise. Increased orientation and mobility work. Increased work with assistive technology and cutting-edge technology. Lots of independent living skills. And another area I want to raise is work on executive functioning skills, time management, planning, following complex sequential directions, general organization skills that many of our young adults are challenged with now. Our students are no different. But executive functioning coaching, which is something I have great background in, is often the special sauce that really helps students begin to have a different perception on what their struggles are, and it empowers them with new tools. So what we are doing is launching this program August 20th. It's an innovative program. It's based on the research that we've done, and it recognizes what Carol Dweck was talking about, a sense of belonging, goal setting, and looking at the human condition of these students. Our program's twofold. We work on both blindness skills and college skills. Our students will gain an understanding of their capacity and be able to practice it independently over the course of 9 months, as skill builds on skill builds on skill. At college, our college success students will be allowed and take college classes in the Boston area based on where they arrive at us with their skill set. We're going to place them in classes in collaboration with partner colleges that are appropriate for where they are and build them up to the next level. But they're going to come back every day to our campus, to our dorm, in an environment that mimics a college campus, but it has a combination of knowledgeable support with our staff in college success. It's a standalone program on campus, intentional challenge, and earned independence. We launch August 20th with 10 dynamic students, amazing students from 6 different states. Special shout out to North Carolina, New York, and Florida particularly, who have really been phenomenal partners in helping make this possible for some of our students. We're going to support them in independently gaining access and support and seeing what that's like through their Office of Disability Services. We're going to visit a lot of them and help these students practice describing what their needs are, what helps them learn, and encounter difficulties in achieving them. We're going to help support them in acquiring the supports that they need. Students will take courses either on campus or online, depending on what our goals are. We may have a student who needs to really prioritize orientation and mobility, and they're going to take an online course and work on O&M in another context. When they encounter challenges in, like, writing, if you think back to your first college paper, right, and think of how fantastic that was for you, we're going to be there supporting them, teaching them writing skills, teaching them research skills, reinforcing the skills that they're learning in their college classes from an executive functioning perspective, from a writing coach's perspective, and then send them off to go practice. Do we want them to learn how to do college as independently as possible? We have a full-time orientation and mobility instructor, full-time VR instructor, and we really, really are committed to helping these students gain their independence. By spring, our 10 students will be taking up to 2 college classes, and I'm in the home stretch, man. Our students will take two college classes, have monthly job shadows that have been specifically designed for them, and learn how to juggle their schedules, their free time. How do I exercise? How do I take on that leadership opportunity? How do I become involved with my local ACB affiliate and fit that in, right? All of this will be supported by four classes taught by our TVI, Kate Cadillac, who some of you may know. These courses are going to be the college experience, Know Your Rights, Health and Wellness, and the pre-employment experience, which will really dig into what lights these students' fires and how are they going to identify classes and potential majors and potential colleges that address those. So, on top of it all, they'll be mentored. We have three of our staff who are have various visual impairments, and I am really excited about the team we've acquired and that have chosen to join our program, and our kids are really going to do something neat here. We're going to be assessing the whole year round, so we will come back next year with some updates and some insights and some adjustments, I'm sure, to what we're doing, but that's what college success is, 9 months of practicing and hopefully beginning a new conversation in how we change these numbers and we change the experience of our students so we can benefit from all they have to offer, as we clearly saw in the world. So thank you for your time. If you have questions, I'm happy to answer them off the side. Thank you.
You're listening to Council Connection on the Talking Information Center Network. The show also airs on the second Tuesday of the month on ACB Radio Mainstream at 9 p.m. Eastern. If you have any questions or comments about the show, please leave us a message in the new BSCB Fillmore box at 773-572-6312. And you can also listen to this month's show in our Fillmore box by choosing submenu option 7, or by visiting our website, www.acbfma.org, and looking for the Council Connection page. For me, one of the biggest reasons to attend the ACB National Conference and Convention is to keep abreast of the latest in technology. I learn a lot by visiting the exhibit hall, and of course we can't really capture that here, but I also learn a lot from presentations in the general sessions. Comcast has been a pioneer in the development of set-top boxes and other technological advances having to do with video description. Here's Tom Vlodkowski to tell us what the company has been up to this year.
I'm Tom Vlodkowski. I'm with Comcast, as Kim mentioned, and wanted to give you a brief update on some of the things that we've been up to over the past year. One of the things that we've done is look to update some of our product offerings. So if you're using the Talking Guide and you're using video description on our service, making it easier to access. So a couple of things that we've done is created a collection page for all shows with video description, whether they're live, whether they're on demand, and now, because you can access Netflix through our service, whether they're on Netflix or not. So you have about 800-plus titles that you can access right through one easy-to-access location. So if you have our X1 service and you say shows with description, that'll bring you to a dedicated page where you can access all of this content. And some of it will be live, and it's all clearly labeled and compatible with voice guidance. Some of the other things that we've done is made it easier for you to get to accessibility settings. And that was a big piece of bringing all of these settings that are known to optimize the service for accessibility under one menu. And actually just having one shortcut key to access it. So if you have the X1 remote, you can press the B key on the remote, and that'll bring you right into the accessibility settings where you can adjust the settings for closed captioning, video description, and voice guidance. We've also added to voice guidance the ability to adjust the speech rate of the screen reader. Nobody wanted that feature, huh? So that's out there now. And what you would do is, again, hit that B key. They'll take you to the accessibility settings, move over to voice guidance options. You open voice guidance options, and you will find the speech rate. You have regular, fast, and fastest. And that's the first of several enhancements that we want to do in that area for adjustment to voice guidance. Eventually, we want to get into an expert mode versus beginner mode so that you can minimize some of the announcements that you hear. But also in restructuring how we announce screens, you can we have hint text similar to what you would get on an iOS app. And so trying to get better at how we position that so you don't have to listen to that text. Speech is always interruptible. So that's one area. Some of the things that I mentioned, Netflix, that is available to you now. So if you have a Netflix subscription and you have X1, you can just say Netflix, or you can go into it from the title on the description page, and you can find all these things that are there. The other piece that we've been working on is our mobile apps. And so if you haven't used our mobile apps in a while, they've come a long way. And there's a few that I wanted to talk about today. One is our Stream app. This is our TV application. We call this our second screen experience. And if you have the Stream app for iOS or Android and you're in your house, the app performs just like a cable set-top box. And so whatever you can watch on your TV, you can watch on your app when you're connected to your Wi-Fi network within your home. When you're out of your home, you can download DVR recordings, you can watch a bunch of on-demand content and live TV that we have the rights to show when you're out of home and on the go. So that's an app that you might want to download if you haven't already. We're getting some good feedback from the community on that. Another one is called XFi. This is, if you have our high-speed data, our broadband service, you're able to manage your router, manage your gateway, and understand what devices are on your home network. And so that's another one that I would recommend. I want to remind people about our toll-free customer service number. So if you need support on anything related to accessibility or in general with respect to Comcast, you can call between the hours of 7 a.m. and 12 a.m. Eastern Time, and that's 855-270-0379. You can also visit comcastsupport.com/accessibility, and we have an accessible live chat interface there as well. You can also email accessibility@comcast.com to get more information. And coming up real quick here, just wanted to highlight a couple of things back to video description, because we had another interesting partnership earlier this year where we actually commissioned a survey that was looking at how accessible video description is to consumers. And we found very interesting results. 626 adults were surveyed. 277 reported as having no functional vision. And what we found is that, probably no surprise to us, that we, those of us who are blind or visually impaired, are watching just about as much television as our sighted counterparts, 4 to 5 hours a day on average. 81% are watching about an hour a day. 55% are watching 4 or more hours a day. And the one piece of this survey that came out that we are really working on is 65% of those surveyed said that they're having difficulty finding content and accessing video description. So this was not just in our Comcast service, but this is outside and just throughout the country. And so that really tells us we have a lot more work to do with our content providers, studios, networks, and we're really looking to start work on that now to find ways of improving the awareness of video description, improving the awareness of talking guides. And so look for more information be forthcoming on that. We partnered with the American Foundation for the Blind and ACB, who helped us. And I do want to publicly thank Kim and Eric and really Tony Stevens and the team at ACB, who are just great partners with us. anything we ask of them, they usually find a way to accommodate, and you know, vice versa. We just really value the partnership with ACB. So I want to just publicly acknowledge that as well. And this year, we had the great privilege of partnering with NBC Universal to bring live description of the Winter Olympics and the Winter Paralympics. Finally, wanted to also just let you know about some other ways you can access our service. If you have a Roku box, you can download the Xfinity app on the Roku box and look for Xfinity apps coming to smart TVs like Samsung smart TVs, and we'll be supporting their built-in accessibility. So that's kind of the quick update, Kim, of what we're up to, and really thank everybody for your support, and keep the feedback coming as we look to improve our service now and moving forward. Thanks so much. Have a great convention.
That was Tom Bludkowski sharing the latest innovations from Comcast. If you've tried to purchase a major household appliance in the last few years, a washer, a dryer, a dishwasher, you know that it's getting harder and harder to find appliances that we can use. A lot of them have digital displays, a lot of them have touchscreens, and even if you can find an appliance with buttons, pushing the buttons tells you nothing. It seems, though, that all of this is about to change. Let's listen now to a father and son team as they describe the work they've been doing in this area.
My name's Sam Duplessy, and beside me is my son, Jack. He is a 15-year-old, and I just wanted to share with you what we've done through the company that I work for, First Build. I think to show what Jack has been able to invent, you really need to understand a little bit about the company that I work for and how we can develop products, and ultimately we're finding some solutions for accessibility that were that are out there, that are stuff that we've got talented young men like my son Jack that can work on and develop for us. But just a little bit about First Build. First Build is a wholly owned subsidiary of GE Appliances, and we're a little innovation studio where we try to design, build, and sell appliances with 20 people. And so that's a little bitty place. We're on the University of Louisville campus in Louisville, Kentucky. And yeah, go Louisville, even though I graduated from UK. it's all good, though. We hire a lot of U of L students, and we love our relationship with the university. But We develop products in an open way. We have a maker space where we have lots of tools, and we put all those tools there for us to make appliances and innovate, and we try to make 12 new things a year. Through that innovation, we thought maybe we can invite others to come in openly and innovate with us, and that's how our doors get open to people like Jack and others who have the capability to invent things, and that we open our doors and let people to come invent with us. So one of the ways we get ideas is through community. You can join our community. It's online. You can come in our door and give us ideas. But we also do something called a hackathon. And a hackathon is where we invite several hundred people to come spend a weekend with us. It's 24 hours a day. And we'll try to break up into teams of three to four people, and they try to compete for prizes of who can make the best thing. And we don't really limit it to what they can work on. We try to do it in the home, because being a part of GE Appliances, we'd like to have solutions in the home. And one of our hackathons a couple years ago, our prize winner was a cooktop that was for the visually impaired. And it had some really unique features that we thought were rather simple that hadn't been invented yet. It was an induction cooktop, and it had burner locators built onto it. So when you placed your pan, it auto-located on the burner. It had some voice enabled so you could command it through Amazon. And it also had proximity sensors, so when you approached it, it would tell you if a burner was on or if a burner was hot. And we thought it was unique. And we, as an appliance manufacturer, had never worked on anything, you know, that specific before. So what that did, it made us reach out into the community because we want to build for our customers. And we reached out to American Printing House for the Blind and said, do you have anybody on your technical team that could come, you know, assess this? Is it any good or not? And Larry Scutcheon, who you may know or have heard of, came in and he said, this is really great. And then he says, looking at it, he goes, it must look wonderful. And I was like, well, where's he going with that? But he goes, but I could never use it because it didn't have knobs. And we just started thinking, you know, he's opening our eyes to how to take a really nice appliance, and maybe we did introduce it with cap touch, which was harder to use, but it'd been a lot better if it just was introduced with knobs. And so we started to learn. And he said, by the way, your laundry is becoming impossible to use. It's all electronic. The knob spins 360 degrees. There's no home position. You go, can you just, you know, give me a home beep on this? And at least I know where the knob is. And this is where I turn it over to Jack, because Jack it was a programmer. And I gave him the idea of, can you help me make this thing have a home beat? Jack, why don't you just tell everybody just a minute about yourself and when you started programming, and then talk about your device.
So I'm 15 now. I started this project around 2 years ago at the end of eighth grade. And I've been a pretty active programmer since around fourth grade, so I really wanted to take up this project. So the device itself, we instead of just making it beep, I thought actually try and make it speak out voices so it could announce the setting, the actual settings that were being changed on the washer and dryer. So we started to prototype that, and we got that a simple idea of what we were thinking to make the washer and dryer more accessible, you know, working in a weekend. So when you turn the knob, it would say cottons or normal or whatever it was, you know, it would announce the setting as it was, as you interacted with it. So, and the device itself, we made it run on a Raspberry Pi, which is a very small computer about the size of a credit card. So, and we continually improved it. We after we added the knob, trying to make the knob more accessible by, you know, adding the voices. There's some other buttons on the washer and dryer, and we made it work with both the washer and dryer. So there's different buttons, and we made those speak, and we tried to do as much as we could. And we sent it's a box with this computer inside of it that hooks into the back of GE washer and dryers through a service port. And we sent it back for feedback, and we got feedback. We found bugs, you know, what could change, what could we add. And something we did add was you could get how much time was left on a running cycle. So just many different things as it continually improved and got better and changed for the development of the device. So
I've got a little bit of a recording of what the device does. I'll just skip through pieces. I've got a recording that's on my phone of how the device sounds. What Jack implemented this a couple different ways. The first thing he did was a text-to-speech editor that let him develop it quickly. Then we went to recorded voices when it was a simple implementation. But as he started adding features that were requested by the people testing it, and Jack didn't mention, we got to test it at Kentucky School for the Blind in their dorms. And there's a Kentucky office for the visually impaired that has a living learning center, and we put units there. And also Larry Scutcheon helped us develop this. We had a pair at his house. And with all the feedback, we went back to text-to-speech, and Jack played with the voices. But here's what it sounds like.
For the talking washer module, when you turn the main knob, it will speak each setting. Here are the settings.
Casuals. Delicates. Active wear. Cold wash. Deep wash. Rinse and spin. Sanitize. Jeans. Heavy duty. Bulky items. Towels and sheets. Wipes. Colors.
Some options may vary based on the model of washer that you purchase. In addition, depending on the cycle, you can adjust spin speed.
Spin level. No spin.
These are just some other options that we added.
Go ahead. Go ahead. That's okay. We can tell about the pause, the key one, the status.
So it would go through. It will also when you start a cycle, it'll say, you know, starting whatever cycle with however much time left. So that was some feedback we got to add a feature to query how much time was left while the machine was running. And you can walk up to it any time and get that feedback, how much time is left, what's running, what the settings are.
So you know if it's got like 20 minutes left in the cycle, you press the button. It'll tell you how much time's left, and you can go about and do something else. That really came back in feedback from the dorm at the Kentucky School for the Blind. But then Larry said that, hey, this is really helpful because you never really know when it's going to be done. So the story doesn't end there. We did put this product for sale. Being a company that wants to sell things, we put it for sale, and we offered it. We have it for sale on our website. We build it to order. It works with GE washers and dryers that are late models, and we sell it for $199. We didn't stop. We engaged the University of Louisville senior design team to help us redesign it to try to get cost out of it so that we could offer it for less. They've designed a plastic housing and reduced the number of parts. Jack reprogrammed the user interface so that it's easier to use. And we hope in the next month or two to start offering the same device, same functionality that works on more models of washer and dryer, GE washers and dryers, for $99. And we learned a lot. And part of what I have to do in my job as head of technology is feed technology back to GE appliances. So, you know, even if we don't put the development where we add speakers in every washing machine or every appliance, we can change some of the controls so that if it's going through four different settings, at least what the top setting has a different beep. So that when you're changing that, you can know where you are at that one position. There were so many little things that we could do that improve the accessibility of our controls. So we fed that back, and that's now written into the standards when they launch controls. And we've got some models, actually, that do have speakers already in them. So a couple weeks ago, asked, it's a dishwasher, and I asked their interns in computer science. I said, this unit has a dishwasher, and the beauty of electronics these days, if it does make things more complicated, the microprocessors are becoming more powerful. The dishwasher microprocessor that has a speaker on it had enough capability where we programmed it to talk. It's not in production. We're a ways away from being able to produce it, But we don't have to add any cost. We just have to program it and enable a voice function to that device. And it's something that I continue and passionately work with and try to get our teams to engage on. So we have proof of concept, and I hope maybe sometime next year that we can come and tell you how we've been able to do that in other appliances.
You're listening to Council Connection on the Talking Information Center Network. I'm your host, Steve Dresser. Earlier this year, Miralee Talkington appeared on NCIS in the role of a blind woman who helped the NCIS team capture a criminal by describing what she heard. The role in itself is unusual, but maybe even more unusual is the fact that Miralee happens to be blind. Here she is to tell us a little bit about the experience of playing that role and what it's like to be a blind actress in a sighted world.
Okay, just so we get on the same page, if you hear me, please clap once. If you hear me, please clap twice. If you hear me, please clap three times. Awesome. Speech over. I love that I got invited to be here. I am so honored and stoked to be in a room full of such deeply passionate, intelligent, fierce humans. So Eric wanted me to talk about NCIS, and I'm going to talk about NCIS. But first, I want to set an intention. And that intention is, for the next 20 minutes, I want to set an intention for myself and for everyone here of transformation. And the reason I'm setting that, I just decided this morning that I wanted to set that, because last night, after NCIS aired, there was a Q&A. And somebody asked me, so do you face any obstacles? And I said, how long do you have? And I realized when somebody asks me that, I can go down the obstacle rabbit hole very, very quickly. Because there are so many. There are so many in the business that I've chosen to be in. There are so many in the world we live in. But if I just stand here and talk about all the obstacles, then how boring is that? So what I do want to do is give some context, because the obstacles are real, but I'm more interested in how those challenges turned into opportunities. So, but I do want to give one statistic that I'm not sure a lot of you know. In the entertainment industry, persons with disabilities is the most marginalized, underrepresented group across the board. Yes, of course. And I just want to give you throw a couple numbers. And a few of you that were at the video last night heard this. But in terms of marginalized groups, the one group above us is the Latino population. Only 5% of characters on television are Latino. And then it goes up from there, and white being the white males being, of course, the top. Our numbers are 9 people in 10,000. So our gap of representation is enormous. So I want to talk about the art here, but I'm also, you'll see that like being an advocate, I have to. There's no choice. Every room I walk into, I must advocate. I must. It is my responsibility, because those numbers have to change. They have to. Okay. A little bit background. Okay, just so you know, a little context, my vision. I was born with rod cone dystrophy, which is kind of similar to cone rod dystrophy. It lives in that family. I have no central vision. I was born with a big blind spot. I do have peripheral vision. That peripheral vision has been decreasing over time. I'm light blind. I'm getting more light blind as I get older. So that wonderful light that's being shown in my eyes right now, thank you very much. So light actually not only, you know, causes more vision loss, it's painful, which is an interesting thing because I've been a stage actor for almost 20 years, and so I'm up on stage with 40,000 watts in my eyes, which is a wild thing. But so my mom is blind. She has the same thing. What I have is genetic. And I grew up going to these conventions as a kid, but I always went for her. I was out going to Disney World. You know, peace out, have fun, do your thing, I'm going to go play. So it's really awesome to kind of circle back around and come back here and be here for myself. But having a blind mom, you know, when you have generational disability, I think it's a very different thing than having an able-bodied parent with a disabled kid. For me, I got the talk in fifth grade. That's what I like to call it, the talk. And she sat me down and she said, you have a choice. You can either look at people the way you need to look at them so that you can see them. And that's with my peripheral vision, which means I would look to the right or to the left. And I just want to preface this by saying she was doing the best she could with the strategies that she had. So I'm not judging her at all for this. So she said, you can either do what you need to do, look to the left or the right to take in what you need, or you can look people, you can teach yourself how to look people in the eye. Now know that if you look to the left or to the right, they will treat you differently. That is the world we live in. And so she didn't tell me which way to go. She just presented that choice to me. And as a child, I wanted to fit in. I wanted to survive in this world. I did not want to be different. I wanted to fit in. So I taught myself how to look people in the eye. And I still do. It's part of my muscle memory now. It's not even a conscious thing anymore. It's just part of my makeup. So I play both sighted and blind characters. So, and in fact, 95% of the characters I play are sighted. And people don't know. It's a trip, right? So, okay, great. First acting class, UC Davis. I failed because I didn't go, because I was too nervous. I was so self-conscious. I was so terrified of myself, of putting myself out there, that I didn't even go. Didn't even attend. Failed out of that class. Okay, 5 years later. Graduating from UC San Diego. I got a decent grade point average going, not totally awesome. I was studying psychology and, what was I studying? Psychology, great. I wanted to raise my grade point average, and my friend was like, hey, take an acting class. And I was like, no, I can't. I don't want to do that. That's freaky. And he said, it'll help you get an easy A. And I was like, done. And I jumped into the class, and it felt so good. It felt so good to step into somebody else's shoes and tell a story and to learn about somebody else by speaking their words. And I loved it. And I got good feedback. And so with my one acting class, I moved to LA thinking I'd be a star. That didn't work out. Moved to San Francisco. Decided to get training because that might help. And right before I went to training, I had my first audition experience. And I went in, and I had never experienced a cold read before. And a cold read is when they give you the sides there, they give you the script there, and you're supposed to read it. And I show up, and I didn't know that. So I spent 2 hours trying to track down a photocopy machine to enlarge it so I could read it. Found one, enlarged it, went back into the room. It was still so small that I had to press it against my face. And the director, after 2 hours, the director said, if you can't read the script, you don't belong on stage. And this is one of those moments. This is one of those pivotal moments. where the pain was so severe I could have quit right then and there. But I didn't. I decided to go and get more training. So I got to fast forward the story because I did get more training. I went to class after class and I battled with teachers who told me I didn't belong there, and I said, I do belong here. And I found other ways of doing things, and I actually got into grad school, American Conservatory Theater, which is one of the best MFA programs in the country, and I got into that school, and I'm still the only, actually there's only two legally blind actresses in the country with an MFA in acting, and I'm one of them. And that, yeah. There should be like 100 of us already, but that's another story. So I go through grad school, and this is where challenge becomes opportunity. Is every time somebody said no, I had to reframe it so that their no's meant a yes to me. It meant, no, I'm not supposed to go through that doorway. I'm actually supposed to go over there. They were just signposts leading me in the direction that I actually needed to go. For example, there was and this doesn't have to do with my blindness, but it does have to do with like affirming my own vision for myself. There was a show that I was doing called Master and Margarita, and I was cast in The Angel of Death, and I had no lines. And the director said, I have long red curly hair, and the director's Eastern European, and he said, I want your long curly hair to be everywhere. And that's all I have to say. And I said, actually, if I'm the angel of death, I should be gender neutral. People shouldn't know if I'm male or female. So, no, I'm going to have a short black wig on and you won't know. And he's like, fine, okay, whatever you want. And he was saying, I had no lines. So I wasn't being called to rehearsal. So all of a sudden I just started showing up and putting myself in the scenes. Because I'm like, if I'm the angel of death, I am everywhere at all times. So I put myself in the entire show. And the thing was, is that I didn't really understand what I was doing at the time, but the feedback I was getting from people, from the teachers, were like, well, you have to fit into the director's vision. And I was thinking to myself, but he doesn't have a vision for me, so I have to create a vision for myself. So that was one of those moments, because at the end of that show, who do you think the character was that people remembered most? The Angel of Death. Okay, fast forward. Graduate from ACT. Go to New York. Think I'm going to make it big. This is the acting industry. It's very difficult for anyone to make it big. It was very hard. Very, very difficult. And I'm not going to dance around that at all. But to get through it, I created my own work. I created my own show, several. I started writing and directing, and that gave me a lot of not only self-confidence, but I was able to have an outlet to sort of crack open my brain and express the things that were going on in there. Let's just keep fast-forwarding. In New York, creating my own work, not getting any work from other people, having a tough time, have a breakdown actually, move back to San Francisco, because that's where I was from, and recover. Create a community there, or I should say, find a community there. And realize that as I start auditioning, I had to learn how to accommodate for myself, because I had no mentors. There was no other blind or low vision people I could look to and say, how did you do this? How did you do this? So each audition experience I went into, I had to figure it out, and I did. And each play I was in, I had to figure out how I was going to do certain things, and I did. And I had to learn how to talk to people about it, and I did. And I made a lot of mistakes along the way. You know, sometimes conversations were very difficult and very awkward, but they happened. And I started getting a reputation around Bay Area for being a great actor. That just happened to be legally blind, which is really cool, because I never wanted a reputation of being a great legally blind actor. I want a reputation of being a great actor, right? So One way in which opportunity or challenge was turned into opportunity, and this is sort of like something like this happens in every play. But there was one show that I was doing, and I'll get to NCIS, I promise. But there was one show I was doing. I played five different characters because I do a lot of
transformational stuff, you know, sort of just changing characters all the time.
So I was doing this show where I was playing five different characters, and one of them was a soldier in World War I, and I had four different castmates, and the opening scene of the play, we had to literally launch ourselves over a 10-foot-tall ledge onto the ground as though we were diving into a trench. We were carrying rifles and bayonets and wearing gas masks. The first time I did it, all the guys just jumped right over, and I just couldn't. I had to go very, very slowly because they could see all the footholds. I had to feel my way down. And the director said, "Do we need to change this?" And I said, "Just give me time." So I took my own time. After every rehearsal, I would go in and I would climb down that trench over and 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 over. I probably did it 200 times. So that by the end of it, or I should say by the end of rehearsal and the beginning of opening, I flew over that trench with the bayonet and I didn't stab anybody. That was a big win. Okay, fast forward. I'm doing well in San Francisco. I'm getting lots of big parts. I'm working in big theaters. I'm having good conversations with theaters. I'm getting theaters to actually start audio describing for the first time. I said, if I'm in a show, you're going to audio describe it because I want my people to be able to come and watch me. Three more minutes? Yeah. I just got the 3-minute mark. I know, I'm sad too. So you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to talk about NCIS. Yes. That's how this rolls. It was awesome. When I booked NCIS, the first thing that I got was a phone call from the director and the producer. And they were like, "So how is this going to work? I'm not sure. We've never worked with your kind before." No, they didn't really. So that's hyperbole, but that's how it felt. I decided to write a cheat sheet for them of how to work with which I'd never done before. I was like, "Here you go. Here's the language you use. These are the identifiers I like. When you give me direction, I may not look at you, but trust me, I'm listening." And kind of went through this whole sort of step by step about how things are going to work. And unbeknownst to me, that cheat sheet made its way around the entire NCIS production. Plus the next show that I was on. So it actually circulated through CBS. Did I tell you that, Eric?
No.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. Well, I didn't know that because I had jokes all the way through it, too. I was like telling the director they should wear feathers because I could see feathers. She didn't do that, though, and that's too bad. Anyway, I'm so bummed. I've been talking, so I want to talk about NCIS. I will say that one of the things that did happen that was so extraordinary with NCIS, and this is why it was such a win, they were committed to authentic representation. And so every moment, every opportunity that I had on there, I upheld that. I upheld their commitment and my commitment. For example, when they got the script, I saw the final draft. I met the writer. I was like, "Brendan, it's so great to meet you. I have some notes." He was totally open to it. Awesome. First day on set, Mark Harmon. Yeah. Silver Fox. That's all I'll say. We were in dialogue. How would this actually go down? And everyone was open to those conversations. They changed the condition that they had written for congenital glaucoma. I was like, "That's sighted people are going to not know, but my blind community will know. So you need to change the condition." And so they changed it to my condition. Awesome. And through the dialogue, too, there were moments where Brendan Fahili, who was awesome, and the director gave me some leeway. So I was like, I think, can I change the language here? They're like, great. Can I change the language here? Great. So it really became this truly authentic piece that I'm so deeply proud of. And NCIS deserves so much of that credit. And I also want to say, because I feel like I'm going over the 3 minutes now. I did my own stunts in that. Which they weren't going to let me do, but then they met me and they're like, oh, okay, no, she can do it. So I got thrown down on that couch, grabbed, my hair got grabbed, I got thrown down on that couch about 15 times. But all this to say that there is something extraordinary when we choose to have a vision for ourselves that others don't have for us. Right? Yes, right. And to go forward into each room and say yes to me. Yes, yes, yes. Because we're going to hear so many no's that we must say yes to ourselves. We must. And our community. And with that, my intention, I must leave with an intention for you, for me. We've got some gentlemen speaking to my left right now. I'll be done in 2 minutes, I promise. That's how I roll. Okay, I want to leave you with a quote and an intention. Some of you may have already heard this, but Marianne Williamson, our deepest fear is not that we are inadequate. Our deepest fear is that we are powerful beyond measure. It is not our light. It is our light, not our darkness, that most frightens us. We ask ourselves, who am I to be brilliant, gorgeous, talented, fabulous? Actually, the question is, who are you not to be? So my deepest intention for all of you right now is own your fabulousness. Own your absolute uniqueness. Own your power to be magnificent creators of your own reality and destiny. Thank you so much.
And with that, we come to the end of Council Connection for the month of August. If you have any questions or comments about the show, you can leave them in our Fillmore mailbox at 773-572-6312. Or you can listen to the show again by going to submenu option 7 in the same box. You can also hear our show by going to the Council Connection page on our website, www.acbofma.org. I'm your host, Steve Dresser, hoping that you've enjoyed this month's show, and inviting you to come back again when we return in September for another edition of Council Connection. Enjoy the rest of the summer, and take care.